Welcome all to this press conference after the third oral arguments, in this case, interminable judicial case. My name is Andres Gomez. I'm a member of the National Committee to Free the Five in the United States, and I also represent a coalition of six Cuban-American organizations in Miami that for the last 8 years have been supporting the right of our five brothers to attain justice. We have a program of at least of seven speakers. They will speak shortly, but will address the major issues. It's very important for the press to know that we have a large number of important personalities that represent very important lawyers association and jurists association from Latin America and from Europe, which are, and Canada. Excuse me, sir. So without further delay, I would like to introduce Heidi Bogosian, who is the Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild of the United States.
Thank you. The National Lawyers Guild is a progressive bar association with special expertise in legal cases of political significance. For 70 years, we have defended individuals and social movements in this country that the government has unfairly targeted for political reasons. This is one such case. And since the beginning of the Cuban Five case, we have been supportive, submitted two amicus or friend of the court briefs, especially on the issue of venue. Briefly, politically charged cases present several unique characteristics, and we've seen all of them in this case. One is overzealous prosecutors using the charge of conspiracy, as we discussed today, often when there is little evidence to convict on other underlying charges. We saw that today where the inference, and inference after inference, are often subject to wide interpretation. Politically charged cases also see vilification of the defendants. In the press, here we learned about a year ago that the United States government actually paid members of the media in Miami to print unfair coverage about the five and also about Cuba. And this went on during the trial. It worked, by the way. A poll conducted in Miami at the time found that about 90% of the poll responders had negative feelings toward Cuban. Finally, in political cases, we see prejudicial and persistent prosecutorial misconduct, as we did in this case. In addition to inflammatory comments used by the prosecutors, here invoking the emotion-laden term terrorist when describing the defendants, we saw several other extraneous prejudicial influences from the court refusing when a juror complained that he feared for his safety during the trial. The court did nothing. When Castro-hating families held a press conference on the first day of jury selection, the court did nothing. And when the three-judge panel chronicled in great depth the impossibility of receiving a just trial due to prejudicial influences in Miami, the Attorney General of this country asked the full 11th Circuit to review their well-reasoned decision, setting the stage for the repoliticalization of this case. I'd just like to close by saying that the National Lawyers Guild will remain committed to work with other legal organizations around the globe to draw attention to this highly political travesty of justice, one that flagrantly violates both U.S. and international norms of justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Heidi. Next, I would like to introduce Judge Juan Guzman, who was the main prosecutor for 7 years in the trials conducted against dictator Augusto Pinochet of Chile.
Thank you very much. I don't know whether I'm heard well. I think it's better this way. Okay. Well, today, I think the issues were very clear. They stood regarding the irregular conduct from the government. We had a proof today that there was an irregular conduct towards this panel of justices of this Court of Appeals when the lady, I don't know her name, excuse me? Yes, the state's attorney, yes, when she said, well, you didn't read all the evidence, you only read the evidence that came from the defense, and she repeated this. So I think that this is what we call prevarication, prevaricato in Spanish. I think it's prevarication in English. This is a felony. You cannot do that. I think the judges were very serene, not reacting. I think that they want to conserve their objectivity, and that is why they did not say at least that they were in a very irregular conduct, having a very irregular conduct against them. It was very clear also, and the lawyers did an excellent job today when they emphasized in the irregular conduct, especially when the prosecutors spoke about how come you, the taxpayers, are going to take over this trial that has to do with people that tried to destroy the United States. And according to what the lawyers said, this was repeated in three occasions during the first instance trial in Miami. Our colleague just spoke about the where are you, the colleague just spoke. Well, she has to fly. Well, I wanted to ask her, but she spoke about the prejudicial influence towards the jury. Well, the only fact we all know that the trial took place in Miami is, well, it wasn't the place for a fair trial. And that was very clear today. They didn't argue very much about this issue, but that is a clear thing that the judges have and that the judges already ruled in that matter. I think that these two judges, the president and the lady who was in that panel, have this issue very clear, and they already dictated the annulment of the case in one occasion, and in the plenary they voted for the position that they had in ruling, in overruling, dictating the annulment of the first instance decision. It was very clear, and the lawyers of the defense made it very clear that there was lack of evidence, and there was even a confession of the lady, lawyer, that belongs to the prosecutor's side, when she says there is no evidence whatsoever that there was espionage. She didn't mention anything about conspiracy, but this is very interesting. When the judge, the president, asked, there has to be two parts for the conspiracy, two sides for the conspiracy, and I see only one side. Where is the other? There was no answer. So I am absolutely sure, as I've been a judge 36 years of my life, 21 years I have been a judge in a court of appeals, two courts of appeals, and if I had to rule in this case, I would rule as fast as I can in order to not have these five Cubans one day more in prison. Thank you very much.
Now I would like to present Mr. William Norris, who is one of the original lawyers of the trial. He represents the defendant, Ramon Lavagnino.
My name is Bill Norris. You didn't hear my voice earlier today because we let the appellate professionals take care of arguing before the appellate court. I was one of trial counsel, and I represented Ramon Lavagnino. I'd like to make a couple of comments about two things this afternoon. One is the dynamic of this appeal, the dynamic of this case at this point, and the other is a couple of observations about the process that you may not be aware of. The dynamic is fairly straightforward. Judge Pryor was asking questions that suggested that perhaps the prosecutorial misconduct was not that severe, that it was fair response to things that the defense had said during trial. The reason for that is this. If you look to the evaluation of the sufficiency of the evidence to support a count, and the jury verdict has returned a verdict one way or the other, guilt, obviously, in this case. If the jury has said that they're guilty, and you draw all inferences from the facts that you can to sustain that verdict, in other words, you do everything you can as an appellate judge to sustain what the jury has done. If there's something to corrupt that verdict, call the integrity of the verdict into question, then the standard of review changes. So if there's prosecutorial misconduct, there has to be overwhelming evidence. And in this case, as Richard Clue said, the government has not only never said there's overwhelming evidence, they've never said the evidence is even strong, just that there's some evidence, okay? And that's the piling of inference upon inference. So that's the dynamic of what's going to go on with these judges as they look at this thing. The other thing that I'd like to comment on is on the nature of the process. We had somewhat in excess of an hour today to discuss a case that took 7 months to try. And getting an hour is extraordinary. Normally, you get half, the total case gets half an hour, which means both sides get 15 minutes. And if you have five defendants, you can do the math. You have 5 minutes to do your argument and then get up and rebut what the government has said. Obviously, you can't do much more than clear your throat in 5 minutes, unless you talk really fast. So what that means in terms of the process is simply this. We had some very, very factually specific questions, and we had questions that dealt with cumulative error. So it's not just a question that there were 28 objections, but how did those 28 objections pile one on top of the other? And how did those issues go through the entire trial? Ladies and gentlemen, there's no way that even as skilled an appellate counsel as Brenda Byrne and Richard Clue are, that they can squeeze all of that into 30 minutes. They have to give the overview, they have to hit the high points, and trust the judges will do their job, and that's review the evidence very carefully. And they've already shown us with a panel opinion, two of the three judges on this panel did an outstanding job in announcing what we all know as trial lawyers in Miami, and that's that you can't work for Fidel Castro and get a fair trial in Miami, Florida. It just can't happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I would like to introduce a very dear friend also, longtime supporter of the Five, longtime supporter of just causes in the United States, Mr. Leonard Weinglass.
I'll be brief, as I have already spoken about the case yesterday and again today. We're pleased with the hearing today. I think we accomplished everything we set out to do. The court established several markers right at the outset. Number one, we are not barred from raising the question of prosecutorial misconduct the so-called law of the case doctrine. Before we even got up to argue, the court has ruled that we won that issue, which means the court now will examine prosecutorial misconduct. And the court, two judges of the court, emphasized that 28 sustained objections is a lot. As a matter of fact, there has been no case that we have found where 28 sustained objections resulted in anything except a new trial. So we are on the road to success with the argument of prosecutorial misconduct. The question that remains is whether or not that finding, and I think we'll get it, will result in setting aside the count of conspiracy to commit espionage. And in that case, what the court has to do is to look through all of the evidence and see, as Bill has pointed out, whether or not the government's evidence is overwhelming toward guilt. And as Richard Klug pointed out today, that evidence, if anything, is a close question, but it is certainly not overwhelming and certainly not strong. The case law requires that once prosecutorial misconduct is found, the case is set aside unless the evidence of guilt is overwhelming. So I think we've accomplished that today. I also think we've accomplished knocking out count three, conspiracy to commit murder. Judge Birch pointed out immediately that the government conceded when it went to the 11th Circuit Court during the trial that it faced an insurmountable obstacle toward gaining a conviction. That was the government's assessment of its own case. They put it in writing, and they submitted it to the 11th Circuit in an extraordinary writ. Despite that assessment by the government prosecutors of their own case, this Miami jury found Gerardo Hernandez guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, where the government had an insurmountable obstacle. So I think count two, the life sentence, count three, the life sentence for Gerardo, I hope both of these counts will go out. It remains to be seen how much of the rest of the case will be set aside because of misconduct. So I'm very hopeful and optimistic. I think this court is primed to do the right thing. I think finally we're going to begin the process, hopefully, of winding this case down and allowing the five to go home to their families. Thank you.
I'm sure that I reflect the opinion and the feelings not only of our five brothers, the defendants, but of all of us in showing our appreciation to the defense lawyers for all their work and the sacrifice that this has entailed to all of you. We are really very thankful. Now I would like to introduce a most dear friend, a very formidable fighter for justice and freedom, former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody here. I'm going to step back from the nitty-gritty of the argument and the history of this misbegotten case after I give my heartfelt thanks to the heroic defense lawyers who spent nearly a decade of their lives struggling here, for the defendants and their families who've lost nearly a decade of their lives, in a case that should never have been brought, clearly. There are other truths that are self-evident, and one of them is that people who want to end terrorism, stop terrorism, prevent terrorism, don't persecute people who are struggling under very difficult circumstances in a foreign country to prevent terrorism themselves. And that's exactly what's happened here. And we know it. What did they do? Where were their guns? Where were their explosives? Where were their plans? How did they know what the plane going down was going to do and what Cuba's reaction would do? How could they possibly know? They couldn't. What they were trying to do, and it's something we should want them to do, is to prevent terrorist acts against their country from our soil. My history goes back on this pretty long. I was in the Department of Justice when the Bay of Pigs occurred. I loved President Kennedy. I can tell you the letter that I wrote to him that day when I heard about it. I said this: the best judgment has no advantage over the worst when it's ignorant of the facts. And I believe then, I believe now, that he was ignorant of the facts. I mean, it was April of 61. He hadn't gotten the seat warm in the Oval Office, and these people were clambering onto the soil of Cuba. We ought to remember we sent four invasions to Cuba between 1850 and 1860, and Jefferson Davis was in charge of one of them because we wanted another slave state. Mm-hmm. How is it that people don't pay attention to the fact that a fellow like Emilio Constant, the head of FRAP in Haiti, mm-hmm. responsible for how many thousands of deaths and tortures, mm-hmm. has sanctuary here when he wants it? How is it that we let a man that boasts of blasting an airplane out of the air with young Olympic hopefuls and welcome him? And we do that constantly. And until we face up to the responsibility that we have, we had agents of the Shah of Iran bullying Iranian students and other people from Iran here lawlessly in violation of our laws, knowingly for decades before he finally was forced from office by his own country. We ought to try to practice things that do prevent the violence, that prevent irrational violence, that prevent deadly violence against people that are just trying to live normal lives. And to do that, we ought to welcome anybody who can come in here and help root it out. We ought to get these Cuban prisoners home immediately. The United States government ought to dismiss the charges against them. It ought to admit its error. It ought to pay them for the injury it's inflicted on them and their families, literally. If it were a just society, we would do that. And it ought to give them visas for re-entry unlimited if they want to come back and help us solve the problems of terrorism that are generated here on our soil. Thank you.
Now it's my pleasure to introduce a woman, a fighter well known here in Georgia and in Atlanta, right. Former U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney.
Thank you very much. I would just like to first associate my words with the courageous legal leader in this country on international issues. He's everywhere that Americans are not supposed to be. And that's Mr. Clark. But it was just brought to my attention that two of the five fought apartheid in Africa. They're true freedom fighters. And they helped to create the new South Africa that we all have high hopes for. But I would just like to say that three of them, okay. That I would just like to say, though, that we now are faced with a new United States. It was once a country that welcomed the huddled masses who were trying to escape tyranny, torture, economic oppression, dictatorship. It was a country that was open to people around the world who had a grievance against state-sponsored terrorism, that they could find protection within our borders. But now the American people are confronted with a new reality, and that is that this is no longer the United States of the greatest generation. This is a new United States, one that welcomes Emmanuel Constant from Haiti, Luis Posada Carriles, one where the worst of the so-called terrorists can be found on CIA payrolls now. We have become exactly what Martin Luther King Jr. feared at the time of the Vietnam War that we were, the greatest purveyors of violence on the planet. And it hasn't stopped. I just hope that the Cuba 5 can prevail in the United States as their fight for justice and a new South Africa prevailed in Africa. Thank you.